Diane Bell has had a remarkable life. Started out as a primary school teacher in the 1960s, has gone on to get a doctorate, spent nearly 20 years in the United States, where she retired as a professor emerita of anthropology. And she wrote the book about the Narrangeri event, you'd have to say, the Narrangeri Warrawan, which is the world that was and will be. And this particular book is being re-released next Monday, an update, if you like, on what has happened to the women that were involved in that particular matter, which is now more than 20 years ago, which was to do with the Hindmarsh Island Bridge. And Diane Bell joins us on the line now from Canberra, where you're based these days. Good morning, Diane.
That's correct. Good morning, Ian.
Now, this event, it's more than 20 years now, isn't it? More than 20 years on.
Well, it's 20 years since Robert Ticknor, the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, placed the ban on the site, yes.
Now, just remind our listeners, now, there was a bridge that was going to be built to Hindmarsh Island, because there may be someone listening to this who wasn't even born when this happened. There was a bridge that was going to be built.
There was a proposal to build a bridge, which originally there were objections to it. The state of South Australia allowed the sites to be desecrated, which were registered. The people who felt that this site was sacred to them and that the bridge would desecrate it took out a federal application, which is the legislation under heritage legislation that should your position of last resort. And from there it wended its way through the courts with applications that failed through no fault of the Narrangeri, and eventually the bridge was built. Where I take up the story is what's happened since then.
Now, at the time, of course, there was the Royal Commission, and then there was a subsequent inquiry as well. Just tell us about the subsequent inquiry that came after the Royal Commission, because the Royal Commission ended up saying that you could build the bridge, couldn't you? That was
The Royal Commission, the question that it had to ask, which was somewhat of a loaded question, was had the women fabricated, was there a deliberate fabrication in order to thwart the building of the bridge? And the bridge was needed, according to the developers on Hindmarsh Island, so that you could have easy access to the marina because the ferry was too slow. So the next major inquiry that you're talking about is actually a trial of which Justice John von Dusser in federal court made the decision. And this was not on the veracity of the women themselves. This was a compensation case where the developers claimed that they had lost a great deal of money because of the delays in the building of the bridge caused by the original declaration by Robert Ticknor. So they had sued all parties to that declaration, everybody that was involved in it. And in August 2001, Justice von Dusser found that they had no cause, there had been no damage done to them, that the women were in fact witnesses of truth. So we have a decision in 96 finding deliberate fabrication. We have in another jurisdiction with a different set of questions a finding that they are witnesses of truth.
I'm talking to Diane Bell about her book Narrangeri Warrawarran, and it's an exhaustive study of the events, isn't it? I mean, it's a great document in the sense that you've gone through and you've spoken to, well, nearly all the people involved, but you didn't speak to the dissidents, did you?
No, I didn't, but I was able to read everything they've written, and I have been able, of course, to follow their testimony and follow their lives. I've also been able over the last 20 years to continue doing field work with the Narrangeri community. And one of the interesting things about anthropology is you're not just taking one statement in time. You're listening to what people say, and then you're matching behaviour against their statements. So a person may say, you know, one thing at one time, another thing at another time. But for me, it's how those play out in behaviour, and I think that's how you get to the core of beliefs.
Now, one person who has since passed on since the time that this all took place is Christopher Pearson. Now, he used to write for The Australian, The Financial Review, and one stage, I think, had his own paper. I think he was the editor of a paper in Adelaide at one stage, wasn't he?
The Adelaide Review.
Used to write extensively about this matter. He said, Professor Bell, the latest defender of women's business and its fabrications, is almost as brazen as her informants. Did you ever sit down with him face to face and say, look, I want to put my case to you?
No, and it's very interesting. It wasn't only the women that were accused of fabrication, anybody who worked with them. And Christopher Pearson apparently had enormous problems with the concept of weaving. And weaving is one of the key concepts I use in the unravelling, if you like, the various stories and cases and behaviours and which ones might be worth following and not. Because when women weave, they're actually that story time. Weaving is the creation of the universe. You create it from the core of the weaving in the centre, which is the centre of your being symbolically, and you make the world. So I use that metaphor of the strength of weaving as you weave in the different lengths of the strands, which are like the different members of a family, which together, bound together, are strong. So I use that weaving metaphor, which is one that is very strong within the Ngunnawal, because one of their first cultural principles is that all things are connected. And Christopher Pearson found that very, very distressing. And I think it's partly because women's weaving has always been seen as craft work rather than as part of the religious domain with symbolic importance.
Well, in fact, I hope that Christopher Pine's listened to this, because he did say to me once, he said, who's the glassblower and basket weaver you're going to have on your program next? I think we've had the glassblower, Nicholas Mount, who makes these beautiful, I think, bottles of wine that sell for $160,000, and now we've got the basket weaver on. We're talking to Professor Dyer Bell. Now, have you done any of this?
Well, I would say that those mats have survived for centuries.
Have they?
I'm not sure how long Mr. Pine's views might last.
But no, it's interesting, though. When you are talking about the matters that were raised in the Royal Commission, I found it fascinating that you were able to go back to records that went back to the early part of the 1840s, didn't you? You found
you found
historical documents which supported the idea that there was women's business particularly connected to this part of the river system, wasn't there? This was the things you've discovered went right back to the very beginning.
What you find are little clues. In the early missionaries records in George Taplin, you find the word being recorded for one of the major dreamings of the area, one of the major stories concerned with the Seven Sisters. That word was missed because he hadn't translated it. But then in the 1930s, Norman Tyndale comes along, and the person with whom he was working, Milleram, also known as Clarence Long, Milleram told him that that word in fact meant the Seven Sisters. Now, one of the planks of the Royal Commission was that there was no evidence for the activity of the Seven Sisters. That's the Pleiades constellation in the sky, which moves, you know, one side and the other of the Milky Way and marks out the seasons for the Ngunnawal, that did not have any existence within the Ngunnawal world. Now, so here we have these clues that you can trace through. And then in the Tyndale papers, which had just become available when I started doing this work, I found a map of Goolwa, which is where the bridge was being built. And the people had always said that Ngurundiri, who's one of the major creative heroes of the region, created the Murray River and separation of Kangaroo Island from the mainland, that Ngurundiri had also been at Goolwa. So what I was building up was this picture of ancestral activity, a very busy intersecting ancestral activity at Goolwa, which is exactly what you would expect because it's where people used to meet for ceremonies. There were burials there. There was trading there. So what I was getting was this rather lovely woven picture.
All right. Betty Fisher has called in. Betty, understand you gave evidence to the Royal Commission. Which one did you give to? This is not the second investigation, but the Royal Commission. Is that correct, Betty Fisher?
Was the High Marsh Bridge inquiry.
Yes. And you want to say something this morning?
Oh, I just want to say hello to Di.
Oh, do you? Oh, good. Okay.
Hi, Betty, and I do remember talking with you, and I remember your work, and it was wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Okay, well, everybody, I hope if the women are listening, those women, because some of them have gone, and I'll never forget them marching with those banners, and it was just a wonderful united time with those women. And they said to me, how come you're here? I said, well, Gladdy told me. And with Gladdy, I met Kumai, and Kumai talked, and Gladdy talked, and they talked together about what they knew, and it was wonderful. And you remember that, Di?
I do indeed, and the tragedy of it is, Betty, that these vindications, and you know that the site has now been registered by the South Australian government, that all these things occurred too late for those women to know, because Veronica Brodie,
yes,
had passed away, Doreen Katinry had passed away.
Yes.
The leadership of the Ngarrindjeri Nation has taken a dreadful knock in terms of the passing of Tom Trevorrow and his brother George Trevorrow,
yes,
and Matt Rigney. So we've had this enormous loss matched against real recognition of the site. The South Australian government has apologised.
Yes.
They apologised in 2010 after the hurt that they'd caused.
Yes, well, it's what will happen is that the kids will find out, and they will keep their stories, they will keep their country, and it comes down to the land, doesn't it?
It does indeed, and one of the most positive things that's happened is the strategy that the Ngarrindjeri have pursued, which is one of thank you for saying sorry, but we need to act. And they've entered into a series of agreements with various local councils and state instrumentalities, which are called Kunin Ngarrindjeri Yunnan Agreements, which just means listen to Ngarrindjeri speaking. And these put them on a formal footing with local councils and the state government so that there is a formal agreement as to how things will proceed. And that involves recognition of the Ngarrindjeri as the traditional owners. So there is a future for those generations.
Now,
years before that, I remember in Victoria Square, a young fella came up to me and he said, "The land is us and we are the land." And I said, "And it is true." And glad he said that. Okay.
That's correct.
All right. Look, thank you very much for calling in, Betty Fisher. Now, Di Bell, just before we go, we had Gillard Zuckerman, who is the Professor of Endangered Languages, talking to us just a couple of weeks ago. And he said it's very, very important that people who are from an Aboriginal group have the access to their language. And he talked about Aboriginal language rights. Now, how important do you think is that call of his to say that there should be more study of language and more access to language by young Ngarrindjeri, for example?
Well, I think the language carries the meaning and the music and the symbolism and the spirit of a people. Just to give you an example, in Ngarrindjeri, the word for land is rui and the word for body is rua, which is the plural of rui. So immediately they're making the connection that land is body. That's almost untranslatable into English. People talk about their ngachi, which in English we'd translate as totem, but that's a very poor translation because your ngachi is your best friend, your companion. When your ngachi sicken and die, you know that you're going to be in bad shape. So when the country was under drought and animals and birds and plants were stressed, Ngarrindjeri said, "You know, our ngachi are stressed, our country is stressed, our rui is stressed and our rua are stressed." So that access to those deep meanings that, to use the metaphor, are woven into the culture are terribly important in terms of people having that identity that sustains them in times of enormous attack and disrespect, which is what the Ngarrindjeri have in fact survived and come out the other end.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Diane Bell. The book's going to be launched on Monday. If people want to get a copy of it, the book is simply called Diane Bell, Ngarrindjeri Warra Warren. I hope I got the Ngarrindjeri right, or at least approximated the correct pronunciation. Thanks for your time, Diane Bell.